morning, Cascadia. You're listening to your community radio station, KBOO Portland, Oregon, at 90.7 FM. Today is Monday, March 30th, 2009, and this is Air Cascadia. Long on content, short on time. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm William Delta.
China has been denied involvement in the electronic spy network, which researchers say infiltrated computers in government offices around the world.
A team of scientists reported to Congress that salmon produced by hatcheries in the Columbia Basin are no substitute for salmon spawned naturally in rivers.
And President Barack Obama has asked General Motors head Rick Wagner to step down.
Portland area weather, mostly cloudy, slight chance of showers this afternoon, highs in the 50s. Tonight, clouds, showers, and temperatures in the 30s and 40s. And then tomorrow, more of the same.
And first, we go to regional news from around Cascadia. Last night, APAC, or the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, held its annual dinner at the Middleman Jewish Community Center. Over 100 protesters were there to greet attendees and remind them that they are essentially supporting Israeli war crimes. KBOO's evening news director, Jenka Soderberg, was there and has this report. Greetings, Jenka.
Hi, Chris. Thank you. And so last night, the protesters gathered outside of the Middleman Jewish Community Center. There were over 100, as you mentioned. The organizers said that they have been extremely disappointed in the Oregon legislators, and especially Governor Ted Kulongoski. And he became the target of much of the protests as he came to the dinner last night. It's unknown if any of the other Oregon state representatives or senators were at the dinner at this time, but last year a number of Oregon representatives did attend the APAC dinner. This year the protest was much larger than in years past, and people gathered with signs calling for an end to U.S. aid to Israel, an end to the $7 million a day that the U.S. Sends to Israel in military aid and financial aid. There were no real scuffles, although at towards the end of the protest at about 6:30, the police had cordoned off the driveway, which is part of the public sidewalk, and not allowed people to walk across that part of the sidewalk. Joe Walsh, the lone vet, who is known for running for Congress last year on the Green Party ticket, actually walked across that driveway. He's 75 years old, holding an oxygen tank that he was wheeling along with him. The police tried to stop him and said that he wasn't allowed to cross that driveway. They then arrested him and took him downtown and charged him.
Just in closing, what was the reaction in general of the attendees as they were going, and how did they respond to the presence of the protesters?
Most of the attendees didn't respond at all. They simply went on their way, went into the in the driveway. One woman stopped traffic with her car and started shouting about how her son was in the Israeli army, to which Palestinians kind of responded back that that her son had injured and killed Palestinians. There wasn't a whole lot of interaction in that people were going in with their cars and weren't stopping to talk to any of the protesters. There was one report of a protester getting egged, having an egg thrown at them, but there wasn't a whole lot of back and forth.
Anything else you'd like to add?
Just that the lone vet Joe Walsh is now out of jail and has, I believe, a court hearing coming up for the charges, I think, obstruction of an officer.
That was Jenka Soderberg, KBOO's evening news director. Thank you so much for that, Jenka.
Thanks, Chris.
On Friday, a team of scientists reported to Congress that salmon produced by hatcheries in the Columbia Basin are no substitute for salmon spawned naturally in rivers. The so-called experts said that frankenfish can still help restore wild runs if significant changes are made. The report said fish spawned in the wild have the genetic diversity to weather changes in their environment, but 130 years of substituting hatchery for habitat has produced fish that are slowing efforts to restore dwindling runs.
A 1964 treaty signed by the United States and Canada created the framework for joint operation of the Columbia River's dams and divided the power benefits. The treaty led to the construction of three storage dams in British Columbia, which provided flood control and ramped up electrical output at downstream dams. Now, policymakers and academics say the technocratic document, which doesn't address endangered salmon or climate change, is due for a rewrite.
Portland's branch of Habitat for Humanity has built two groundbreaking homes on a quiet corner of Northeast Webster Street. 40% more efficient than houses built to code, the homes are on target to achieve Platinum Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design certification from the U.S. Green Building Council, the highest rating available. They'll be the first LEED Platinum Habitat homes in Oregon and two of only a handful nationally. The houses are showcases for now. Many of their sustainable features are still too expensive to put in all of the 20 or so houses that Habitat for Humanity builds each year in Oregon.
It won't look so expensive when we're flat out of oil, will it?
Mm.
Another pilot program sponsored by the Bonneville Power Administration, the Emerald Peoples Utility District, is offering an incentive to Eugene area homeowners willing to try a ductless heat pump. The incentive includes $1,500 in rebates and zero interest on loans for the device. The ductless heat pumps use electricity to transfer heat between outdoors and indoors, much like a refrigerator.
Mm. Ratepayer advocates want state regulators to suspend a rule that encourages Portland General Electric to expand energy efficiency programs. A traditional rate links the utility's profit to the amount of electricity it sells. This tends to discourage utilities from promoting energy efficiency. And while we're at it, why not give us, the public, another chance to own our own energy source?
The U.S. Coast Guard says a tugboat pushing three empty grain barges has banged one of them into the pylon of the Hood River Bridge across the Columbia River. Right. And QMAX supertankers laden with liquefied natural gas won't pose any problems on the river. That is, if they make it over the Columbia River bar.
Mm. A Lakeview ranching family is using low-tech methods to transform waste from their custom butchering business into high-grade fertilizer. Ross and Kelly McGarva own Lakeview Lockers. They're working with the State Department of Agriculture and the DEQ to use butcher waste to improve soils. Kelly admits he was skeptical, but says it shows tremendous potential as a commercial fertilizer.
Meanwhile, in Harney County, authorities discovered the remains of 60 horses and 20 cattle at a ranch co-owned by a woman who was recently arrested on charges of animal neglect. Sheriff's deputies took Roxana Still into custody after getting a complaint about two horses dying on the ranch. Deputies also saw about 75 malnourished animals and returned to the ranch to remove them. While there, they discovered three pits filled with remains. Composting! Just composting, that's all they're doing, right?
A business group says it expects to receive federal stimulus money to pay for a study examining a possible transportation network to help travelers in Idaho, Utah, Wyoming, and Montana get around more easily. The Yellowstone Business Partnership wants to examine forming a regional transportation initiative in areas surrounding Yellowstone National Park using public and private carriers. Yellowstone. Reduced to a coffee table book and an ATV theme park.
Yeah, I don't like the two terms Yellowstone Park and business group in the same sentence. That worries me. Well, as the world knows, at this juncture, President Barack Obama has asked, not fired, mind you, just asked in passing, for General Motors top dog Rick Wagoner to step down. That plus his request that the unions take another hit for the home team sent Wall Street into the gutter. But, you know, as a plan, I don't think that what Barack Obama was talking about sounded too bad. KBOO Spencer Raymond joins us to consider the implications. Good morning, Spencer.
Good morning, Chris. You know, again, we are seeing things that we've never seen in this country before. First, it was a round of bailouts, and now, on top of the bailouts, it's strict, not really control, but really telling these big three automakers what to do, and the person who's telling them to do that is the president, so you'd think that they better well obey what he says. We should keep in mind that Ford is being left out of all this. Ford was not mentioned in Obama's talk this morning at all. Ford never asked for any bailout money, so that's one U.S. automaker that I guess has things right and has been able to stay going. But, Chris, as you mentioned, you said that GM is being directed, that the CEO, Ed Wagner, told to resign. And what this shows is the Obama administration's willingness to really take the CEOs by the cuff of the shirt, shake them, and say, you know what, you got to get your act together, or we as a government are not going to help you, and we're going to let you fail. And it's not in anybody's interest in this country to see these automakers fail.
So people are querying why, if Barack Obama has asked for Rick Wagner to step down, he did not do the same with regard to failing banks and, of course, AIG. Why, in your opinion, were their CEOs of these entities not also asked to step down?
Well, Chris, you have to look at how the business of a car company and how the business of a bank and an investment bank differ. At the CEO, at the leadership level of a company like a car business, you have lots of decisions being made about product development. How do you market things to your consumers? How do you market them around the world? How do you make a product that is desirable for people to buy? That simply has failed in GM's case. I mean, their auto sales are down. They've been down for years. Honda and Toyota are more common cars in America these days, and they're made in Japan. And so this is a leadership development decision over several years that have not worked. On the banking side, on the investment banking side, it's not just the CEOs who made all these shoddy investments in mortgage-backed securities and that whole bit. It was investors on the more middle-of-the-road employee level who, as a group, worked together to create those black markets that no one really knew anything about. Sure, you can say the CEOs let it happen, but it wasn't a planning. It wasn't an error in planning, per se. It was just a bet to make money, whereas in GM, they just have been designing cars that no one wants to buy.
My favorite part of the whole deal is a Chrysler situation. Apparently, they've got 30 days to come to terms with ownership by Fiat. I can picture it. It'll look like a toaster with huge fins on it. This should be definitely the vehicle of the future. Thank you so much for that. Of course, we've been speaking with KBOO's Spencer Raymond. Thank you so much, Spencer.
Thanks, Chris.
And now a few international headlines. China has denied involvement in the electronic spy network, while researchers say infiltrated computers in government offices around the world. The Canadian research was commissioned by the Dalai Lama's office. He had feared computers of his Tibetan exile network had been infiltrated.
It's truly alarming. The malware that in question here has the ability to see and hear in rooms. It could be remotely triggered. It's something to take careful note of. And, of course, the Chinese government is hotly denying that it is the source of this new bug. And now, O wild west wind, thou breath of autumn's being, thou from whose unseen presence the leaves dead are driven, like ghosts from an enchanter fleeing, yellow and black and pale and hectic red, pestilence-stricken multitudes. That, of course, is Percy Bysshe Shelley, and here's the Associated Press. Plantna and human diseases that travel with the wind can spread more quickly than previously believed. The findings cause concern not only for some human diseases, but also a new fungus that threatens global wheat production. The research concludes that invading diseases do not always progress in an orderly, constant rate, and that some airborne pathogens can actually accelerate as they move.
In London, protesters on the Put People First demonstration marched through the streets, decrying Prime Minister Gordon Brown's carefully laid plans for a G20 deal on worldwide tax cuts. Brown's strategy has also been scuppered by an eve of summit ambush by European leaders. Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, led the assault on the Prime Minister's global New Deal. The Spanish finance minister, Pedro Solbes, also dismissed new cash being pledged. And Nicolas Sarkozy, the French president, has insisted that radical reform of capitalism is more important than tax cutting. This has been Headlines and Commentary from Air Cascadia for Monday, March 30th, 2009. Today's editor is Chris Andre. Engineering is Steve Nassar. The KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Chris Andre. You're listening to member-supported KBOO Portland, your community radio station at 90.7 FM. Your support and your support only keeps us subverting the dominant paradigm. Thank you so much, members.
Coming up next, If You Love This Planet, Dr. Caldicott has media critic Jeff Cohen.
Thanks for listening and have a good day.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Mackenzie River Gathering Foundation's annual Justice Within Reach benefit event, Saturday, April 4th at Pear. The event celebrates stories of hope and justice from around the state. The party features DJ Adiva, a.k.a. KBOO Celeste Carey, and the MRG Foundation / KBOO Community Story Booth, where guests can record their own stories of hope and justice. That's the MRG Foundation's Justice Within Reach benefit Saturday, April 4th at Pear, downtown Portland at Northwest 6th and Flanders. More information, including guidelines for the story booth, available on the MRG Foundation website, www.mrgfoundation.org.
Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott. And in this program, we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Welcome to the program today, If You Love This Planet. We're interviewing media critic Jeff Cohen, who's the founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College, where he's an associate professor of journalism. His latest book is Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media. He has been a TV commentator at CNN, Fox News, and MSNBC, and was senior producer of MSNBC's Phil Donahue primetime show until it was terminated 3 weeks before the Iraq invasion for political reasons. Cohen founded the media watch group FAIR, F-A-I-R, in 1986. His columns on media issues have been published online at such websites as Huffington Post, Common Dreams, Alternet, and dozens of dailies, including USA Today, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, Boston Globe, Atlanta Constitution, and Miami Herald. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Great to be with you, Helen.
Let's start with the fiasco with Phil Donahue, you and MSNBC, and me just before the Iraq invasion, which I think illustrates what actually happened to you and the pressures on you and Phil Donahue at that time.
Well, everything about it was pretty peculiar. I mean, you rarely hear of a television network that cancels its most watched program. And Phil Donahue Primetime was the most watched program on MSNBC at the time. As I describe in my book, I'd spent months arguing with the top brass at MSNBC, saying if you let Phil Donahue be Phil Donahue, and you let us be the one place that dissents from the Bush administration cheerleading on national television, we will have huge ratings. And the reality is that at that time, in 2002, 2003, they were less interested in building ratings than they were tamping down controversy. So, you know, you look at the situation now where they have Rachel Maddow, her ratings are through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
Keith Olbermann, ratings through the roof. And, you know, I feel very vindicated when I see these liberal, anti-Bush type voices that have grown with this audience. It's exactly what I was arguing in 2002 and 2003. And I really hate it when I hear, even in liberal circles, people giving credit to these executives at MSNBC. I mean, these are the same people that suppressed dissent and debate and journalism when it really mattered before our young men and women were sent overseas to kill or be killed. That's when these executives were just practicing censorship.
Why did they do it, Jeff? Tell me the reason.
There's never one reason. I think there were about three or four reasons. One factor is that no one in the mainstream media wants to be apart from the herd. It's basically a conformist medium television news.
That's pathetic, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very sad. And they were afraid, you know, when Phil Donahue would get some dissenting voices on the air, you know, they'd get a few letters saying this program's anti-American. And instead of doing what journalists would do, which is, you know, put those letters and emails aside and let their journalists search for truth and facts, they caved. Another factor is in that period, all the major media conglomerates had their lobbyists on Capitol Hill going to the Bush administration, lobbying for a change in the regulations that would allow these few huge media corporations to get even huger. And it wasn't clear to us at the time that that was a factor. But when we started getting very, very strange orders from top management at MSNBC, and then, you know, a few months after we were all terminated, we realized that at that point, MSNBC wouldn't allow even 1 hour of critical programming because they didn't want to do anything that could get in the way of General Electric and its lobbyists, you know, getting these rules changed, these regulations changed, these FCC, Federal Communications.
Did they get them changed?
The reason they didn't get them changed is because the anti-war movement on the Internet, led by groups like Move On and Free Press and others, were so huge after the war started, in the spring and summer of 2003, that the FCC got more criticism and critical emails that the thing never really went fully through, that the pro-business obliterating of all regulations did not happen because of a popular intervention that had never happened before around a media policy issue in our country.
Thank God.
That was another factor. I think there's another factor that I think you're familiar with from your work in our country in the 80s, which is just old-fashioned Joe McCarthyism. That, you know, there's this sense in the mainstream media that you can have any right-wing nut on the air, like the Falwells and the Ann Coulters, over and over and over. But if you have, you know, even mainstream articulate progressives, then, you know, this legacy. Remember, American television started during the Joe McCarthy era. There's always been this fear on the part of executives of having the left wing heard from, whereas they're never fearful of having the ultra right wing heard from day after day after day.
Yes.
So I think there was a series of factors. I describe all of this in the book, but during different phases, we were given different orders, and a lot of the orders were basically emphasize celebrity and human interest and get away from, you know, hardcore political social issues. I must tell you this.
What?
By the very end, you know, in the last few months of Donahue, we were given orders that every time we booked one guest who was anti-war, we had to book two that were pro-war.
Two?
Yeah. If we booked two guests on the left, we needed three on the right. There was one meeting where a producer said she was thinking of booking Michael Moore as a guest, and she was told she'd have to have three right-wingers for balance.
That is revolting.
Yeah. Yeah,
because
and that order was given week after week.
The media actually orchestrated that war, and what America has done has just been so obscene, and it's still not talked about in big terms, is it, Jeff?
The country has been wrecked. In the U.S. media today, the argument is, well, the surge worked.
Yeah.
It took a while, but peace has come to Iraq, and it's not a big controversy anymore. It's always this pacifying, you know,
it's
the pacifying voice.
Yeah, even the New York Times, which I read every day because there's some good stuff in that, and the Washington Post, they follow that line too.
you know, you're in a country, and most people in the world can turn on the news and actually see the devastation of Iraq.
Mm.
We don't see it in our television news. It's not, you don't see the pictures of civilians. You don't see the toll. All you see is the line of the day. And the line of the day, and I would argue that Obama is somewhat complicit in this, the line of the day is that, well, you know, it took a while, but our soldiers have ultimately brought some peace to the country.
Peace.
But see, Helen, you mentioned two newspapers that were instrumental in the invasion happening.
In
particular, two pages.
Yeah.
The front page of the New York Times had article after article by Judith Miller. Or Judith Miller and Michael Gordon together.
Yep.
And those articles were sheer total fantasy.
Yep.
And they were they didn't have named sources. Almost all of them were anonymous intelligence sources, anonymous Bush White House sources. At the time the stories were published, there were experts on Iraq that said this story, it's hard to refute it because there's no sources, but it just doesn't ring right.
Mm.
And the Times kept publishing those articles.
Even the State Department said that.
Well, there were people inside government agencies that were sometimes trying to knock down what was on the front page of the Times. But the important thing to understand about the New York Times front page is it's the most edited page in our country. You don't get on the front page of the Times without several people looking at it, deciding it belongs there. So it wasn't just the failure of one reporter or two reporters. It was the failure of the whole news editing staff. And the same thing, you go over to the Washington Post, they had 36 pro-invasion editorials in the months leading up to the invasion. And their op-ed page, which is supposed to have diverse views, was also extremely hawkish. You know, when Al Gore made a speech questioning the wisdom of invading Iraq, he was called name after name on the page of the op-ed page of the Washington Post.
So what was the raison d'etre for the Post to be so hawkish in pushing the invasion? What was it, Jeff Cohen?
Well, I think that they've become enthralled to this ideology of interventionism and sort of a soft neoconservatism. Part of it is, you know, part of the whole neoconservative outlook is this idea that anything that's good for the state of Israel is good for the U.S. and global peace and human rights. It's this idea where what's good for Israel and protecting Israel, that should be the almost the number one goal or number one focus. And there's some of these people, and I started seeing this in the 1970s, some of these people who used to be doves and thought that the military budget was too big, now the military budget can never be big enough.
Yeah.
And so I think there's an interventionist streak and tendency, especially around the Middle East, that comes from these Israel right or wrong, I can only call them fanatics or extremists. And I think that's a part of it when you look at places like the New Republic that endorsed the invasion or the Washington Post editorial page that so endorsed the invasion. When you look at those people that are not normally right-wing on everything, but they're right-wing on the Middle East, it's that neoconservative ideology that, frankly, these people don't know much about the Middle East. They think, you know, the more violence, the more militarism, somehow one day, hasn't happened yet, but one day the Arabs and the Muslims will submit. And if they haven't submitted yet, we just haven't used enough force. I mean, frankly, if those people stay in power, and many of them are within the Obama administration, then the whole future world peace is in jeopardy.
Who are the neocons then, Jeff Cohen, who are in Obama's staff?
Well, Obama has a bunch of people. I mean, an obvious one is the guy named Ross.
Yes, Dennis Ross.
Dennis Ross, of course. He left the Clinton White House, and then he was a Mideast expert for Fox News for years. And total hawk, and he's back in.
Yep.
You have a bunch of folks around, you know, that are the kinds of people that were writing the op-eds in Washington Post that are Democratic Party hawks.
George Mitchell is a good guy, though, and he's in charge.
Yeah, and Mitchell is very, had to go through some tough criticism. You know what his flaw, according to these writers? He's even-handed. That, again, if you're even-handed between Israel and Palestine, then you're suspect. Now, how can you bring peace to the region if you're not even-handed? But people were attacking Mitchell because of the, you know, he was under suspicion for, quote, even-handedness. Look at the attacks on this guy Freeman, you know, up for intelligence post. He's been the subject of a relentless attack in generally liberal places, the New Republic, Atlantic, and it's because he is seen as someone who is not Israel, right or wrong, that Israel isn't always correct, and they're frying him over it, and it'll be interesting to see what happens with him. Charles Freeman.
Well, it's interesting, too, to watch Obama. This is a very interesting character, and I think he sort of plays both sides of an issue, but I think within himself he's got fairly determined guidelines and policies which we will see enacted over time. Do you agree with that, Jeff Cohen?
I guess I'm a little more skeptical of him than you. I've never been the one who drank the Obama Kool-Aid. I've always seen him as sort of a conventional corporate centrist voice. Mm. His appointments have been almost universally disappointing. Jeremy Scahill, if anyone Googles it, has written a story about his appointments on the foreign policy area, which Jeremy called a kettle of hawks. What was really interesting is I know during the political campaign, during the Democratic primary, when the Obama team or Obama himself was trying to get a liberal or an anti-war person to come out and endorse him and stand against the Hillary Clinton campaign, the argument that was used over and over was, look, every single foreign policy advisor of the Obama campaign was against invading Iraq, and every one of Hillary Clinton's foreign policy advisors was for invading Iraq. And then an odd thing happened. As soon as Hillary dropped out of the race and Obama felt it was crucial, the Obama campaign felt it was crucial to come across as anti-war because that's where the sentiment of the country is and was. But every single foreign policy person they took on from then on had supported the invasion.
That's
from the vice presidential pick, Biden, who not only supported the invasion, he was instrumental in the invasion when he was the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And then you know, you could even go to people that didn't quite make it in because of tax scandals, like Daschle was the majority leader of the Democrats when he paved the way for the invasion of Iraq. He could so easily have held up a vote on Iraq, but Daschle allowed a vote to happen before there was real debate and allowed it to happen right before the November 2002 election.
Yeah.
So you had one after another of these people that, like, were brought into the administration as soon as Hillary was gone and they no longer had to, you know, try to use the anti-war argument against Hillary. You had them basically taking all the Hillary people, including Dennis Ross, who's one of the most fanatically anti-peace forces when it comes to Israel and Palestine inside the, I guess he's still inside the Democratic Party. Who knows when you spend years featured, you know, week after week on Fox News Channel.
I'm interviewing Jeff Cohen, media critic, who is the founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College and Associate Professor of Journalism. I've known Jeff for probably over 20 years, and he's one of the few people who is an outstanding independent journalist and has watched the evolution of independent journalists over time. Let's talk about the need for independent journalists and independent media at this time in the United States, Jeff Cohen.
Well, the good news is that while the mainstream media, especially daily newspapers, are in complete financial crisis, and of course a spiritual crisis that I don't think they've ever gotten through, given the cheerleading around the war in Iraq, as the mainstream media have been suffering a spiritual, political, financial crisis in the last, say, six, 7 years, the independent media growth has been astounding.
Has it?
You know, you have a bunch of blogs that started in 2002 based heavily on skepticism about invading Iraq, you know. And those blogs, like, came out of nowhere and took off. I'm thinking of places like Daily Coast, which is one of the hugest blogs in America today.
Daily Coast.
Yeah, dailycoast.com.
Yeah.
And then and another is Atrios, A-T-R-I-O-S. You can just Google any of these. And, you know, they started in 2002, and within a couple years, because the mainstream media cheerleading for Iraq was so bad, even on that one issue, and it's not the only issue these blogs dealt with, even on that issue, people built up a certain trust. Like, isn't it interesting that the independent media got the facts right about Iraq, and the mainstream media, the so-called professionals, got the facts so wrong? And, you know, look at Amy Goodman's show. You know, she started 12 years ago, Democracy Now!, heard on Pacifica. And, you know, she started basically out of a broom closet at the New York Pacifica station
BAI.
12 years ago.
Yep.
Yeah, BAI. And she's built that into the biggest public media collaboration today, seen on television, seen on radio, seen on satellite television, seen on the web. I mean, it started as radio. Now it's radio and television. I think... you look around and you see, gee, these independent journalists are maybe more trustworthy on big issues of war and peace, environmental degradation, corporate corruption. At the Park Center for Independent Media, which I run at Ithaca College, we're giving out the first annual awards named after the independent muckraking journalist I.F. Stone, Izzy Stone. We're calling them the Izzy Awards. And the award is being shared this year by Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! And this incredible blogger named Glenn Greenwald. And Glenn is another amazing success story in independent media. He'd been a constitutional lawyer up until 2005, an attorney. And then he started blogging. I mean, it was like the Bush, you know, shredding the U.S. Constitution that got him into blogging. And now... In 2009, he's one of the most respected writers in America today. When, you know, if you go online, you can see senators and Congress members quoting him on the floor of Congress.
Oh.
He didn't start operating as a journalist, you know, commentator, blogger until 4 years ago. Again, there's no one who's quicker to dig up the prior statements of a huge media figure, a huge political figure, to show how that person is being dishonest today. He gets a lot of tips. This is another beauty of independent media, a more direct relationship with your community.
Yes.
You know, in corporate mainstream media, they look at their people as consumers, as customers, as audience.
Yeah.
But in the independent media, you know, there's such an intimate relationship with your community, and you find that so many of these bloggers are getting rich information and tips and insight on an hourly basis from their readers, and then that becomes part of the conversation. One of the people we had speak at Ithaca College, one of the recent heroes of independent media, is another blogger known as Josh Marshall, and his blog is called Talking Points Memo. Josh Marshall, he started during the time of the Florida recount in 2000. He was the proverbial blogger in his pajamas, just doing it part-time at night.
Yes.
But over the years, he built this thing up where when he needed help, his community of readers would send him research. When he needed money to cover, like, the New Hampshire primary in 2004, they donated money so he could buy a car and go up to New Hampshire. So by 2006, 2007, now he's hired other people to do investigative work with him. And they're the ones who grew suspicious when they heard that one of the federal prosecutors in 2007 had been fired by the Bush White House. And they started relying on their readers, their community. They said, hey, has anyone heard of anything else that's sort of suspicious? And over a period of months, the Talking Points Memo blog started crusading about this issue of politically motivated firings of federal prosecutors by the Bush White House, and it ended up leading to the U.S. Attorney General having to resign. Think about it. Like 20, 30 years ago, if a cabinet member resigned, it was usually because maybe the New York Times or the Washington Post would, you know, had deployed a number of reporters and they dug up a scandal. Well, here you have bloggers working with their community who brought down a U.S. Attorney General. If it wasn't for the Talking Points memo and these independent bloggers, it's possible that story never would have gotten out. So you have the New York Times and the Washington Post sort of having to play catch-up after a bunch of bloggers dig the story up.
Do you think then that the conventional media, like the Times and the Post and the, you know, the networks, have any understanding of what's happening and how they're being left so far behind and actually losing money because of it, because they're just not really in the mainstream at all?
Well, I think some of them do. And, you know, these are huge institutions.
Yeah.
And there's some smart people and some dumb people at every institution. I mean, I was surprised when I saw, and pleasantly surprised, that, you know, one of the most important pages of the New York Times is the letters page, and the second most important is the op-ed page.
Yeah.
They ran about 4 or 5 weeks ago, they had an op-ed on the New York Times, which said that maybe the way to save daily newspapers, which are so struggling in this country and elsewhere, is to endow them as nonprofit independent institutions like universities and colleges. You know, that's an argument that progressives and independents have been making for a long time, that not only is it a way of saving these publications, it's a way of putting them on a new independent footing. Daily newspapers are so crucial to covering a city hall, covering a state capitol, covering Washington. Some of the better newspapers have some very good reporters still employed by them. But I just thought it was a real breakthrough when even mainstream thought is, let's turn some of the, let's save a few of these newspapers as nonprofits, try to get them endowed, and that way, gee, imagine how journalists could be unleashed.
Well, now, why can't they be unleashed now? And I think of I.F. Stone and Walter Lippmann and others who and Murrow, who spoke and wrote the truth. I mean, what is it now that holds them back? Is it the shareholders? I mean, why are they conservative?
Well, I think there is that problem of that corporate ownership. That if,
what do you mean? I don't understand.
Well,
how
I'll give you an example. I'll give you an example. In the early 90s, and, you know, I was at FAIR at the time, the Media Watch Group, we started seeing, and it's happening again, as Obama talks about health care, but when the Clintons were talking about health care reform in the early 90s, we were sort of stunned that instead of covering the news and covering the various options that were being put forward in the 1990s for health care reform, including one plan that was endorsed by 100 members of Congress, which was for basically enhanced Medicare for all, a national nonprofit national health insurance, single payer, they wouldn't cover it. The Times.
Yeah.
And the coverage was just purely propagandistic. It wasn't even, there was not even a pretense of covering the news. It was more like they were dictating a parting line. So we did a lot of research at the time, and we found that on the board of the New York Times, the corporate board, were several people who were also on the boards of giant pharmaceutical companies.
Oh.
Several of them were on the boards of big insurers.
Mm.
Again, I don't think the board was calling up members of, you know, who are writing these stories, but just to have those kinds of people as your owners. And I worked at MSNBC, as I've already described you at the beginning of this conversation.
Mm.
The sense of fear in the newsroom when I was there was palpable.
Really?
And the fact that these giant corporations own the TV networks, and more mid-sized corporations own the newspapers, but they are all intertwined with the Wall Street firms, and they're intertwined with the insurance firms and the pharmaceutical firms. It's that sort of corporate
incestuousness.
Like gallows.
If you look at the boards of the Washington Post, New York Times, and all the rest, the directors interdigitate. They have similar directors who just move from board to board at the same time. So, you know, it's all sort of tied up.
Yeah, and it's interlocking.
And it's interlocking, and we're seeing the results, of course, of unrestrained capitalism and unrestrained deregulation now, which is bringing the world to its knees.
And keep in mind that deregulation was not just pushed by the right wing or the right wing media. That much of the deregulation in the area of Wall Street was pushed by the New York Times. You know, and a lot of the deregulation, there's a new study, a crucial study, you should have him on your show, by Robert Weissman of Essential Information. He did a study of 12 major decisions that have been made in the last 10 years that directly led us to the financial collapse that we're in. And a number of those steps were taken by the Clinton administration and in decisions that were pushed by people like Larry Summers, who's in the Obama administration, decisions that were pushed by other people from Merrill Lynch and from, Goldman Sachs.
Yeah.
And you find that these, and remember, no candidate in history ever received more money from Wall Street than Obama did.
Oh,
so I think the same old people tend to be in power. And even with this like complete collapse, as you describe it, I mean, we can identify what decisions were taken and who took them and who pushed them and what editorial pages pushed these things. And it's not a pretty picture, but it's too easy to say, well, it was all Bush, Reaganite deregulation.
Yes.
No,
yes.
It wasn't just
yes.
that.
Yes, it was a combined effort. I'm interviewing media critic Jeff Cohen, who's the founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media. Jeff, then, we've talked about the corporate media. Let's get on to NPR and PBS.
Yeah.
What are your comments about that?
Well, very disappointing. You know, NPR and PBS have been so disappointing that, in other countries that have a higher level of political discourse, it's because public broadcasting is more independent, is more willing to take some chances, has some critical documentaries with regularity. I mean, when there's quality stuff on public TV, it's usually exception to the rule. It's people like Bill Moyers. It's an occasional documentary. But most of its public affairs content is conservative and corporate. And the major daily news show on public TV is called The News Hour.
Yeah.
And Helen, in the 1980s, you might remember that Jim Lehrer, who still runs The News Hour, Jim Lehrer, when producers would come to him, and I heard this from four different producers of the public TV News Hour in the 1980s, people would come. Producers would come to Lehrer and suggest, look, there's this huge freeze movement. There's this huge sentiment in the country. We're thinking of having one of the leaders on. And Jim Lehrer's reaction was, oh, you're not going to stick us with one of those moaners or whiners, are you?
Jesus.
So that was references to people like you. And so
who helped to mobilize 80% of the Americans to oppose the arms race?
Well, of course. I mean, if they had a real debate in our country, any of these points along the last 25 years, maybe we wouldn't have, a military budget that can compete with all other countries combined. Maybe there'd be some sanity in U.S. foreign and military policy. But if you block a debate year after year, even when there's this huge grassroots movement that people like you were so instrumental in building, and you can't get in even public TV's News Hour, then you see the problem. And again, the problem continues today. FAIR did a study of the News Hour, and it was in about, I think, 2006, when the country had totally moved against the Iraq War, and most people wanted the troops out. And FAIR did a study of the guest experts that were on the public TV News Hour, and for every one guest who was advocating withdrawal, they had more than five guests that were advocating stay the course. And again, the majority of the country was on one side, and the hawkish minority got the dominant position on the public TV News Hour. A big part of my book, Cable News Confidential, is who was able to speak during that crucial period you're describing.
Yes.
And who was pushed off into the margins or silenced altogether?
Yes.
Yeah, it's not a pretty picture, but it shows what happens if the corporate mainstream marginalizes dissent.
Mm.
The good news is, as we look back over the last 5 or 6 years, there are certain independent media outlets that you can look at, and you can look at their historical record and say, boy, the things that these people were talking about has come true, and the stuff that was said on MSNBC in 2002-03, on CNN in 2002-03, even Oprah's show, and clearly public TV. You know, we haven't talked about public radio, but during the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, they had very few dissenting views.
Yeah.
The national news that comes out of New York and Washington is extremely timid, elite establishment. And, you know, at the time, people were referring to NPR as National Pentagon Radio.
Or the National Petroleum Radio.
It was so biased.
Yes, well, and the other thing is that they take ads now. You know, they call it underwriting, which is a euphemism for ads. Once you take ads, you lose your independence.
Yeah, I think that public broadcasting in our country was sort of deformed at the get-go when, you know, when it was determined that instead of the proposal that had come from a blue ribbon Carnegie Commission, which said you have to have independent insulated funding, right at the very beginning, in the late 60s, a Dixiecrat congressman went to Lyndon Johnson and said, no, we're going to get to appropriate. And by that threat of cutting down or cutting off the funds to public TV and public radio is a way they've been able to enforce timidity. And as you say, by being the country in the advanced industrial world where a smaller per capita amount of our taxes, per capita funding from the public to public broadcasting, we're like less than every other advanced industrial country. That's what allows the so-called public broadcasters to justify going to these big corporations and getting call enhanced underwriting.
And in particular, I've been absolutely incensed by NPR in the last few years running ads pro-nuclear power. And I know the man in Washington who's the director of NPR, and he was quite nice and received me well. And I said, what are you running these ads for? You know, this is medically untrue. They wouldn't change, nor would they put on me or anyone else giving us equal time to negate what those ads from the Nuclear Research Institute were saying.
Yeah. No, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, there's so many double standards in public broadcasting in our country. You know, at public television, they have big corporations that underwrite programs about Wall Street, about business, and that's considered okay.
Yeah.
But when programmers have gone to public TV and said, we want to do this show about workplace issues and we're getting some of our funding, not all of it, but some of our funding from labor unions, they were told, well, no, we can't have that program on the air. So, in other words, a business program funded by corporate interest is okay. Mm. A workplace program funded by labor unions is not okay on so-called public broadcast.
Yes, I remember in the early 80s, I went as president of Physicians for Social Responsibility to ABC and said we want to run an ad on the medical implications of nuclear war. And suddenly into the room came a man in a charcoal grey pinstripe suit, and he was the lawyer. And he said, well, what's your bottom line? And I was sort of taken aback because as a doctor we needed to talk about the medical effects of nuclear war. And I stumbled around for a while and then I said, well, I suppose it's nuclear disarmament. He said, that's controversial, and he refused to run it.
You know, and yet if you look at these TV networks, they're always running message ads. I mean, every hour I'm watching on these TV networks today, thankfully you're probably I'm seeing these ads for clean coal.
Oh, yeah.
And
another lie.
Yeah, complete propaganda. Everyone knows it.
It's like a safe nuclear war.
yeah. I mean, but the good news is, not all of the networks, but I see at least on CNN, they're running an ad attacking this whole concept of clean coal.
Yeah, that's by the Coen brothers.
Yeah, but I mean, it's funny that, you know, because CNN is often taking ads from one side and not the other, but at least on clean coal, they're taking ads from both sides. But on some TV networks, I just keep seeing these corporate paid for clean coal propaganda ads. They wouldn't let you have an ad.
Even at a time when capitalism is collapsing. Now, let's talk about the phenomenon of Rush Limbaugh, which is absolutely topical at the moment. Jeff, Jeff Cohen, just talk about it. Who the man is, how long has he been on? How many listeners he has, and what he's up to.
Limbaugh has somewhere between 500 and 600 radio stations. People guess at his audience because there's a lot of hype. It's probably around 15 million people, I think, a week. And
I was saying 20 million people the other day.
No, I'm not sure that's right. Mm-hmm. I'd say somewhere between 15 and 18.
Right.
That's my best guess. And, you know, I've been studying him since the 90s. I don't think he's as big as he was at his height, but he's still huge. And then, you know, after him is Sean Hannity's number two. It's a real dominance on corporate TV talk and corporate radio talk, the dominance of the right wing. I mean, Limbaugh is a guy who needs to be a monologuist. He can't win a debate.
Can't he?
Well, he doesn't deal. In fact, he doesn't allow debates. He doesn't go on shows where he has to debate. And he doesn't, and he's admitted that he doesn't have callers on to debate. That's not, he doesn't, that's not what he does. He admits that. He said it year after year.
Mm.
And what's important about Limbaugh is, and why I think his audience is aging and he's not able to replace it.
Oh, they're aging.
People.
Oh.
Oh, yes. Oh, no doubt.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, you know, a lot of young people, they get their, and this is a good thing, they get most of their news on the Internet.
Yeah.
They're not, you know. So, I mean, think about the difference between Limbaugh and a blogger.
Yeah.
And, I mean, a blogger, when a blogger, whether on the left wing or right wing or in the center, if you attack something and you say, and you quote from it, you have to link to the totality of it. And if the people reading your blog don't see a link, then they grow suspicious that you don't really have the goods.
Mm.
If, in other words, if the blogger hasn't made it easy for you to look at what the other side is saying, the side you're criticizing, then you lose credibility as a blogger.
Mm.
And so these bloggers, there's a lot of good debates between right and left and left and center and the blogosphere. It's a much higher level of debate than you see on TV and radio because people have to have sources. And if you claim there's a study, if you claim there's an article that that backs up your point, you have to link to it. And if you don't, you know, no one's going to believe you in the current era of at least intelligent blogosphere, which is thankfully where millions of people are getting their news. Now, go back to Limbaugh. The fact that he is, frankly, the leader of the Republican Party.
Yes.
He's the leader of the right-wing opposition.
Yes.
I would argue that he had pretty much attained that status in the 90s. So what we've been seeing now where any leading Republican who doesn't take the Limbaugh line has to apologize for it within a day or two, that's something we started seeing in about 93, 94. I think that it's really says something about, you know, the state of the two party, that we have a very timid Democratic Party leadership where Obama felt the need on the weekend to call the New York Times and say, hey, all of my actions are completely consistent with free market principles.
Yeah,
unquote.
I saw that. I got shocked when I saw that.
Yeah, well, he felt the need to call them. And here we've had a complete collapse.
Yeah.
Of the corporate free deregulated corporate capitalist system. And he's claiming that none of his reforms will go outside of the box of that. So you have that on the one hand, and then you have a Republican Party that's basically led by a charlatan like Limbaugh who makes stuff up, who can't debate, who's just a demagogue. And it really shows you why our country's political system is in trouble with that one bright spot that I always want to emphasize. This growth of the independent media, the growth of progressive bloggers, the growth of Democracy Now, that's the saving grace here, that dissenting views are getting out and they're getting out to more millions of people because the independent media is just stronger now than it was 10, 15, 20
years. And this radio program, too.
Oh, yeah.
My interview today was with media critic Jeff Cohen, who's founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College, where he's also an associate professor of journalism. He founded the media group FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, in 1986. Thank you for listening today to If You Love This Planet. I think it's been quite fascinating and revealing. And we'll talk to you next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.
It's 11 o'clock. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming right up, it's Jenka Soderberg speaking with John Herson, who just returned from Gaza, where he participated in a convoy of trucks attempting to bring humanitarian aid to that region. At 11:30, Building Bridges presents A Saint on Death Row, as a story of Dominic Green with Archbishop Desmond Tutu. This is KBOO Portland. Stay tuned.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Common Ground Wellness Center and Inner City Hot Tubs, a community wellness center committed to integrative healing through hot tub and sauna, massage, acupuncture, naturopathy, counseling, and more. Now open at its new location at Northeast 33rd in Alberta. Information at 503-238-1065 or soakandsauna.com.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Counseling Center, working with emotional intelligence on relationships, parenthood, divorce, conflict, stress, and more. Portland Counseling Center works with individuals, couples, families, and teens. Information and appointments at 503-295-6265 or portland-counseling.com.
Today marks Palestinian Land Day, a day which commemorates an event 32 years ago on March 30, 1977, when Israeli forces attacked a nonviolent demonstration against wide-scale land confiscation in the Galilee in northern Israel. We will be going live to one of the protests held today in commemoration of Land Day in Nelin Village in Palestine in just a few minutes, but first, we turn to Gaza and the Viva Palestina caravan that recently managed to enter the besieged Gaza Strip with over 200 vehicles full of humanitarian aid. We are joined on the line by John Herson, who participated in the recent caravan to Gaza with humanitarian aid. I believe there were over 100 trucks. John, can you tell us about some of the difficulties that you faced in bringing all of that humanitarian aid from England to Gaza?
Oh, it was an incredible convoy of vehicles. There was over 120 vehicles left England. I was the only Irish participant in the convoy. And some of the obstacles, so there was numerous between breakdowns and political. I would say the best example of a major sort of obstacle we met was the Egyptian authorities who, along with the Israeli authorities, are refusing to let any form of aid into Gaza unless it's deemed medical aid. So that rendered pretty much our whole convoy obsolete. However, we used different tactics to get us in. I covered my whole load with a heavy-duty blankets and disguised my load in as a hypothermia blankets. And thankfully, they didn't have to go through the load, so otherwise they'd have found out a lot of blankets, other blankets, clothes, other medical aid that I had, building tools, a lot of jerseys from Ireland for kids, a lot of children's clothes, all things that are just being refused to be allowed into Gaza at present.
And how many total vehicles were there?
There was 120 vehicles from the UK and then myself from Ireland. And then we were joined by over 100 big trucks from Libya. The Gaddafi Foundation added 100 vehicles to it as well, which gave us a lot of credence. And I can tell you it was some sight of 220 vehicles going across the Sahara Desert for 2 days. It was an incredible sight. It stretched well over 2.5 miles, so it did at one point.
Wow. And how were you allowed into Gaza? I know that it's been really difficult for aid to get in.
It's incredibly difficult. You've no idea. For example, tents that were sent across for the homeless in Gaza were delayed by 6 weeks from the Egyptian side in Al Arish. There is a football stadium in Al Arish in Egypt, and it is just coming down with aid that the Egyptian authorities are refusing to let in. And as you know, the Egyptian authorities are controlled by the US and by Israel in terms of keeping that border closed, in terms of the aid that I think it's somewhere close to $3 billion a year that Egypt gets in order to keep that border closed. And I think George Galloway, who is the MP for in London, at a very high level diplomatic, was able to pull strings to get us in, and a lot of it too as well was through the Gaddafi Foundation through Libya that put pressure on the Egyptian authorities to let us in. I mean, at the end of the day, the sight of 220 vehicles not being allowed in to help the homeless people in 2009 was not a pretty sight, so it's not. And as you might know, George Galloway is pretty much in the news a lot at the minute because last Friday he has become the first sitting MP, Member of Parliament in the UK, to be banned from a country, and that country is Canada. And there's a Mr. Jason Kenney, one of the government officials up there in immigration, whatever, has deemed what George has done in Gaza to be, he's not allowing him in to speak to Canada. George was to go to Canada for a whole speaking tour, and Jason Kenney has now deemed it unfit for George to come in to talk about what he did in Gaza. And so free speech has been denied to the people of Canada by Mr. Jason Kenney. And George Galloway, he's in the US at the minute on a speaking tour, and he's describing about the convoy and about why he organized the convoy in the first place, because the BBC had refused to air the appeal for aid for Gaza. And that's how he started off the convoy, and he's on a speaking tour at the minute, and the Canadian authorities have refused to let him in. So it's quite ironic, it's the first sitting MP ever to be refused access to a country. And he just wants to talk about what he's seen and what is going on, what is the current situation in Gaza.
And I mean, 120 trucks joined by 100 more, it seems like a lot of aid, but given the need, it's still kind of a drop in the bucket. Is there any plan to bring more aid?
You got it. It's like putting your finger on the hole in the Titanic. There's 1.5 million people in Gaza. 75% of them are unemployed. The majority of them have to rely solely on aid coming in. The aid is not getting into them. Even if they were to be sitting, each person in Gaza, £1 million tomorrow morning, they couldn't buy anything because it's not allowed into them. The Israeli authorities deem that it's only medical aid is all that they're allowed in. And that is, you know, how can people live on that, you know? And I was in there for 3 days, and you have no idea what people see on the TV. And I know we had a more liberal television in back home in Europe than probably you have, but you know, to see street after street after street demolished. I mean, it's just demolished, so it is. Their water treatment plant is destroyed. Their sewage works is destroyed, so the sewage is now seeping into the sea. They cannot fish. If a fisherman goes out beyond the little area where that's contaminated with sewage, he's shot, so he is. His boat is blew up. Their whole agricultural industry is destroyed as well. They systematically took out all their cattle industry, all their poultry industry, so they've got no cows, they've got no chickens. They destroyed their trees in terms of the olive trees, citrus trees, palm trees, just basically anything that they could use to either, for eating or for creating some kind of industry, it's gone. You know, they're just left with nothing. And the fact that it took 6 weeks for them to get tents into them, you know, that in today's world, we were all in tears, floods of tears. We just could not believe what we were witnessing. And an hour after we left, bang, American F-16 fighters came in and just blew up that refugee camp. Although there was nobody in it, but just an hour after we left, it was attacked. And there's attacks going on daily, hourly and daily, that we do not know about, that nobody knows anything about. But it is happening. We were there. We can hear it. You know, the drone planes were overhead. Their television is disrupted. Their communication systems is disrupted. They are under constant surveillance. And they're living like, you know, they're in a prison cell, and that's just all you can explain Gaza. It's just one massive prison camp.
Now
the two countries responsible for it.
you wrote about how you were received in Gaza, that you consider the people of Gaza to be the real heroes, even though they were thanking you for the aid. Can you talk about what that means?
Well, basically, we came to Morocco, and from Morocco and the North African state, right the whole way across from Morocco, into Algeria, and we had a border broke down for, that was 17 years closed. They opened the border just to let us through, into Tunisia into Libya, Libya into Egypt, and right across, we had over 500,000 people was waving us along and giving us the best wishes, and we had water and coffee and free fuel, free accommodation. The reception right across, we thought was fantastic. But once we got through the border and into Gaza, I never felt as humbled in all my life, because here were the people that we had set out to help, and there they were to see us, you know. And to the day I die, I will never forget the look on their faces and in their eyes, and them thanking us. And basically, you know, I just wish I had, you know, 10 times as much stuff with me, but, you know, the faces of them, and I can say this much, I've travelled a lot in the world, and without a shadow of a doubt, they are some of the nicest people that I have ever met in my life. They have a fantastic sense of dignity. You know, what they suffer and what they go through, their dignity is amazing. You know, they still hold themselves with pride. Their level of education is way beyond anything that I've ever experienced. Their intelligence, their language skills, they're one of the highest educated, you know, they're pretty much like Cubans, you know, in a way. They're very, very highly educated people. And it's just a shame and disgrace that they're pinned into the prison cell that Israel and the U.S. have them in, you know.
So what's next? Is George Galloway organizing another caravan? Is there going to be an ongoing attempt to aid?
It's a flotilla of boats, apparently, is the next exercise to try, because all the fishermen have lost their boats. Their boats have all been blown up, so they can't fish. And they're planning to do maybe something like that in 4 to 6 months' time. Personally speaking, I want to get involved in trying to create I had over 1,500 football jerseys from back home, mainly GAA jerseys, and they represented loads of different clubs, towns, counties, and cities in Ireland. And I want to try and set up something along that line where we can teach them some Irish football, Gaelic football, in conjunction with extracurriculum, schoolwork like computers or learning English or languages, something like that. Things that will help them to, you know, break the mold. And at the end of the day, knowledge is power, you know, and the more knowledge that they can have, the better use they'll be to the outside world, if they can get out. Because don't forget, they're sitting in a caged in Egypt on one side, Israel on the other, and they can't travel. They cannot get out through that door. You know, they're not allowed out through that border post, and they're basically, as I say, they're prisoners within a big prison cell, and their food is cut off from them. They have no access, and people do not get to see what the reality is in Gaza. And it's I personally would make it my mission to tell as many people as I possibly could, and that's why I'm talking to you in Portland, my old town, and I know there's a lot of very, very good people there. And I'm appealing to people there to please, please, please phone whoever you can, your congressman or your senators, your government, whatever. And please, 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 I'm appealing to everybody that I possibly can to try and do whatever you can to lift the siege of Gaza. Because it's inhumane. And in the year 2009, that a government like America is supporting a regime like Israel that is keeping them people trapped in that prison cell is so wrong, you have no idea. It's horrible. To treat another person, another human being in that regard is a very, very sorry sight.
And being Irish yourself, do you see any parallels between the British occupation of Ireland and the Israeli occupation of Palestine?
Oh, there's total parallels. That's what I couldn't get over, you know. Only it's on a grander scale. It's on a far bigger scale. Like, at the end of the day, we were still fit to have a passport and get out, and we were recognized as a country. But to be not even recognized, you know, as a people, they're not even second class. They're 99th class citizens in the eyes of the Israelis. That's the way they look at them. and what they have to go through. But the sad thing is just, you know, that might not par. I mean, there was over 1,400 people were killed in 3 weeks. We had close to 3,000 people killed in nearly 30 years. You know, we've got the same population of 1.5 million, but their 1.5 million lives in a tiny fraction of the size of Northern Ireland, so it does. Plus, what we went through with Sinn Féin were never recognised. Even though they're democratically elected representatives, they were never recognised. And until they were recognised, we didn't have peace. And once they were brought into the fold, the peace process evolved, and we have a fantastic peace process. Whereas in Gaza and in Palestine, Hamas have been democratically elected, and they are being shunned. And basically, what has been happening is the people are being punished for voting for Hamas, and that's where the siege has really started, was from the day that Hamas got elected.
Do you think that recognizing Hamas, similar to the recognition of Sinn Féin, would bring about a peace process in the region?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, how are you going to try and develop any form of peace if you can't talk to the people that represent the people? You know, they are the democratically elected people, and, you know, crime has come down over 80% in Palestine since they came into, you know, since they were elected. Their recycling is, I would say, probably the foremost in the world, because they don't have anything coming in, so everything has to be recycled. And they are an incredibly resourceful people, you know, and way beyond their mannerisms, their intelligence. You know, they're fantastic people, and they should be. There's no reason why they shouldn't be, you know, at the table. But there's one thing about what is happening in Gaza, make no mistake about it. What's happened there is all about land. You know, everything that's been demolished is closest to the Israeli border. And the Israelis have now, if you go into reading different government officials, their key objective, the next step is they move in and they take that land. You know, and that's what's happened. They just systematically are moving in and taking it bit by bit, you know, inch by inch. Just like the wall in the West Bank, you know, it's an illegal occupation, and the world sits idly by because, you know, what the U.S. is doing in Gaza. I'll tell you, people can see it. That they wouldn't want to be, they wouldn't be proud to say they're Americans, to see what American Caterpillar dozers have done, what American F-16 fighters have done, and what American tanks are doing. You know, and it's pathetic. And I think that maybe close to 8 to 9 billion a year is being spent of American dollars to do that. And you know, America's, I read day by day how much ordinary average American people are suffering. And instead of the money helping them, it's going to eradicate the Palestinians.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for joining us again. I've been speaking with John Herson, who recently returned from the Viva Palestina Brigade, the convoy of 120 trucks that went down from England and Ireland to the Gaza Strip. Thanks for being with us today, John Herson.
Thank you very much.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News. And we turn now from Gaza to the West Bank and actions around the world to commemorate Land Day. Land Day, known as Yom al-Ard in Arabic, commemorates the bloody killing of 6 Palestinians in the Galilee on March 30, 1976 by Israeli troops during peaceful protests over the confiscation of Palestinian lands. We are joined on the line by Akram Hawaja, who is an organizer with the Popular Committee Against the Wall in the village of Nelin in the West Bank, a village that has become a focal point of the nonviolent resistance in Palestine. Akram, thanks for joining us.
You are welcome, and good day for you and for the listeners.
And can you tell us about how the village of Nelin commemorated Land Day today?
Today, as you know, that the Land Day is a special occasion for us here in Nelin, because when you are speaking about Land Day, you are speaking about 2,500 dunams that are loses by the apartheid wall are stolen by the from the farmers, and you are speaking about 1,000 olive tree that are damaged. You are speaking also about a big canteen, like a big prison we are now putting in. It's surrounded by fences that causes by the apartheid law. Also, you are speaking about 4 murders and more than 600 injured. Really, today, also, that the people in the world are celebrate that they have their own land and they are enjoy the living of this land, and we are celebrate of the pain that we are faced from the Israeli by stealing this land. Really, the people today make a demonstration, a peaceful demonstration, to show the world that today is a special day for them. And we are in the Palestinian Initiative movement. We have 3 strategies of struggling against this apartheid world and against the stolen of our lands. The first strategy is the non-violence struggle. You know that we are an innocent people, we are not armed people, so we haven't another way to struggle against this armed soldiers and very powerful and aggressive people that are come to steal our lands. And the other thing is to support the immovability of the people, to support their to still living in this land and not leave it. The third thing, and it's the most important thing, is to make an international solidarity. We are believe of free people in the world that come here to Nalin to solidarize with us. Those people that are grateful people, that are not normal people and ordinary people, they are believe in freedom and democracy to be spread all over the world. Like Cristiano that was injured in the last few days.
Yes, so I was going to ask you about Tristan. Tristan Anderson, yeah. Of course, from the San Francisco Bay Area, an activist,
yes.
A peace activist, an indie media journalist who was shot in the head by a tear gas canister at the recent protest in Nalin. Can you talk about that protest and how Tristan is doing now?
Yes, Tristan is really, we hope fast recovery for him. Really, he was a grateful man, and he lived this hard moment with us. He support us all the time. Also, he collect many of other peoples from all over the world and from the United States to come to Nalin and organize many activities against this apartheid wall, because he believed that it's injustice and unfair to those farmers to lose their lands, to lose their earn of money that they get it from their land, and for shame that the Israeli use the powerful against our peaceful struggle, and he was injured by a gas bomb, and there are many others of soldiers also injured, and some of them was transport to their countries. Really, we are in Nalin appreciate those people that are come to help us and solidarize us against apartheid war.
Akram, I just wanted to ask you about what's happening with Land Day. We have heard about some of the protests that have been going on in Palestine and around the world. Galilee held a protest, Jenin, Qalqilia, Ramallah, mm-hmm. Jerusalem, Bethlehem, and of course Nalin and Belin, the towns that are the center of nonviolent resistance. And the organizers say that this is to mark the ongoing defense of Palestinian land and agriculture from the wall and settlement project, and calling for a boycott of Israeli products and institutions. How do you tie the Palestinian nonviolent resistance and the the farmers' movement, which the village of Nelayan is a part of, as connected to the call for boycott and divestment from Israel?
Yes, you know that approximately 35% of our consume of products is an Israeli product. And these products could be support the soldiers and the army. So we are here in Nelayan in this day. We are organizing many activities. I spoke about the demonstrations. And also we are making some kind of a national boycott for the Israeli product in order to show that we are against everything. We are against everything that support Israeli army, the Israeli army that steal our land, and that that is make us live in a hard situation here in Nelayan.
And how much of your land has been taken in the village of Nelayan?
The first plan was to get 5,000. I'm speaking about the plan, the Israeli plan, to take 5,000 dunam. But before we make a lot of demonstrations and we activities against this apartheid wall, now we will lose approximately 2,500 dunams and about of 1,000 olive tree and other kinds of trees.
And that unit of measure, for people who aren't familiar, a dunam is, I believe, about half an acre. So we're talking about quite a large swath of land. And what are the Israelis using the land for?
They are taking it to make it to make up to broadband the settlements that are near our village, and also they are speaking about security wall. It's really a shame to speak about security wall, because this, if they are want to make a security wall, it should be in the 1967 borders. But this wall, the aim and the idea from this wall is to steal more lands and to use it to build settlements and to get the water resources that are found in those lands, because those lands are having a water resources and a wells that are used by the farmers to agriculture their lands.
And people may not be aware, but 80% of the water wells in the West Bank are now under Israeli control through the settlements. And
yes,
unfortunately, yes. Akram, that's all the time we have today. Again, I've been joined by Akram Hawaja with the Popular Committee Against the Wall in the village of Nelayan in the West Bank, a village that has really become the front lines for the nonviolent struggle in Palestine. And I want to thank you so much for being with us, Akram.
You are welcome at this time. Thank you very much.
And the boycott campaign that is being organized today, the actions taking place around the world, participating cities include New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, The Hague, Buenos Aires, Tunis, Caracas, Venezuela, a dozen cities in Italy, and dozens more cities where actions are taking place for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, in which organizers are calling for a boycott of Israeli goods and promoting boycott, divestment, and sanctions as the most effective tool to end the Israeli policies of land theft, colonization, and discrimination. That's what the organizers of these events are calling for. An Israeli poll that was released yesterday indicates that 21% of Israeli exporters have felt the effects of the boycott. The poll was conducted by the Israeli Union of Industrialists, and that percentage was extracted from a sampling of 90 companies from a variety of industries, including high-tech, construction, textiles, and food products. The local campaign of boycotting Israeli products is is the Oregon Campaign to End Israeli Apartheid. The website, endisraeliapartheid.org. That's endisraeliapartheid.org. We'll go out with Marcel Khalife.
It's 11:30. You're tuned to KBOO Community Radio. And coming right up, it's Building Bridges, presenting Saint on Death Row, the story of Dominique Green with Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. A Saint on Death Row, the story of Dominique Green, with Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
Well, there have been more than 1,000 executions in the United States since the death penalty was reinstated in 1976, leading the nation with 435 executions, 12 of which have been carried out this year, is Texas. Dominique Green, a 30-year-old African-American, was executed on Texas death row.
His story is told by best-selling author Thomas Cahill, who wrote the tremendously moving book, A Saint on Death Row, The Story of Dominique Green, and by Archbishop Emeritus of Cape Town, South Africa's Desmond Tutu. Both continue to raise the cry for the abolition of the death penalty.
Thank you so much, people of Riverside Church. When I was a child, I spoke as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. These words of the Apostle Paul in his first letter to the Corinthians. But what if you were never allowed to be a child? If as far back as you could remember, your life was a life of sadness, deprivation, and horror. How do you put away childish things if you've never had the chance to play? How do you become a man, as Paul says? How do you grow up if you've never had the chance to be a child? Many psychologists would say that unless you have been allowed to be a child, to play, to babble, to explore, to try things out, while feeling parental admiration and the encompassing envelope of parental love, you cannot successfully negotiate the transition from childhood to adolescence and from adolescence to adulthood. The principal destroyer of childhood is brutality. Sometimes brutality descends in the form of bombs from the air that can wipe out houses and parents, children older and children younger, leaving perhaps one small, perhaps mangled child to cope alone with a bombed-out life. This is what happened recently to many children who live in the Gaza Strip between Israel and Egypt. What kind of adults will such children become? Crippled inwardly and outwardly, they're likely to be either excessively timid, fearful people, or hateful, brutal people. And who could blame them for becoming something less than they would have been had they been allowed a normal course of development. Sometimes brutality hits the child more privately, less dramatically, but just as effectively as a bomb. When it comes in the form of a hateful parent, a parent who demeans and belittles the child, a parent who takes out the frustrations of adult life on a helpless child, a parent who constantly humiliates, beats, and even tortures the helpless body of a child. If such a child survives childhood, and many do not, he or she is only too likely to grow up to be another humiliator, another beater, another torturer, and so continues through time from one generation to the next, the dreadful syndrome of man's inhumanity to man. Not a few of the children who have never had a childhood grow up to be lawbreakers who sooner or later find themselves in prison. Rather than taking the trouble to intervene effectively in the lives of such abused children and rescue them, we as a society often just wait till they are old enough to break the law. Then we lock them up. How creative of us. How mean and unforgiving. Let me tell you about a friend of mine, Dominique Green. Dominique spent his teen years as a petty mugger and sometime drug pusher. Finally, having just turned 18, he was tried for capital murder, convicted, and sentenced to death in the state of Texas. Was Dominique guilty of murder? I don't think so. I think he was just guilty of being an abused kid who had no resources to protect him from the charges made by a district attorney who wanted a conviction and didn't care how he got it. When Dominique was picked up by the police, he had been living for 3 years in a storage bin that he rented with his drug money. Why was Dominique living in a storage bin from the age of 15? Because his parents had abandoned him. This after years of torture by a mother who used to hold Dominique's right hand over the gas flame when she disapproved of something he had done. Dominique's father was a drug addict. His mother was an alcoholic and prostitute. She was also schizophrenic and had multiple personalities, some of them harrowing. Over the 12 years Dominique spent on death row, he blossomed into a beautiful human being, a wholly functioning adult. He became a legal expert and was constantly helping other inmates with their cases. He became an avid reader and student, an excellent writer, and even an editor who created a fascinating anthology of prisoners' writings. One book that especially impressed Dominique was a book by Desmond Tutu, the retired Archbishop of Cape Town, South Africa. The book was entitled No Future Without Forgiveness, and it's about Archbishop Tutu's experiences as chairman of South Africa's unique experiment, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, during whose sessions, perpetrators of political violence were encouraged to tell the truth about what they had done in the course of the apartheid era, and the victims of that violence and their families were encouraged to forgive those who repented of their violence. Dominique was deeply impressed by the book and realized that this was the path he and his fellow inmates must take. He pressed the Archbishop's book on anyone who would have it. Under Dominique's leadership, many, perhaps most, of the inmates on death row in the state of Texas forgave everyone who had harmed them and, insofar as they could, asked forgiveness from those they had harmed. Dominique believed he had a vocation to inspire the kids who turn up on death row to drop their petty hatreds and to morph into larger, more generous human beings. In the same way that older inmates, since executed, once provided spiritual models for him to follow. In my first meeting with Dominique, I was able to tell him that Archbishop Tutu was a friend of mine. I doubt anything else I could possibly have said would have impressed him so much. And he wanted me to tell him everything I knew about the great man. Dominique and I spent much of our conversation admiring the sublime courage of Desmond Tutu, who with his wonderful wife, Leah, and their four children, had lived for decades under the constant threat of assassination, yet never failed to speak the truth boldly to those who did not wish to hear it. Everyone here tonight, and the whole world, your grace, is permanently in your debt. The Archbishop visited Dominique, a visit of incalculable importance to Dominique, who said afterwards, "To think Archbishop Tutu came here. Nobody thinks we're anything, but he came all the way from South Africa." Dominique spoke these words moments before his own execution, an execution that went forward despite the fact that the widow of the man he supposedly murdered and the man's sons all pleaded publicly that Dominique's life be spared. This plea was sent as a videotape to Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, and to the members of the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles. The governor was determined to execute more prisoners than his predecessor, George W. Bush, whose number of executions on a per-year basis remains virtually unequaled in American history. Texas, oh Texas, you who execute so many people each year that you have put the United States in the same execution league as the most repressive regimes on earth. According to the best estimates, 1 in 8 of all convictions in this country is the conviction of an innocent person. But when it comes to Texas, no statistician would even hazard a guess as to how many innocents are being convicted of crimes. In this year of 2009, Texas has already executed 12 people, while all other states taken together have executed only 7. Dominique Green was just one of so many needless, heedless, unjust Texas executions. His last words to his many supporters as he lay strapped to the cross-shaped gurney, just before the poison stopped his heart, were these: "I am not angry, but I am disappointed that I was denied justice. But I am happy that I was afforded you all as family and friends. You all have been there for me. It's a miracle. I love you all. Please just keep the struggle going. Thanks for allowing me to touch so many hearts. I never knew I could do it, but you made it possible. You all are my family. Please keep my memory alive." Dominique Green is not dead and gone. Dominique Green, abused child, abandoned teenager, condemned adult, opened his heart and believed the good news. Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
It's wonderful to be in this place of worship, which holds such wonderful memories about the role of Riverside Church in our struggle against apartheid. And of course, who can forget when this great place welcomed the newly released Nelson Mandela. Thank you for having been there for us. This country has inspired many around the world. It certainly inspired us in South Africa. When they introduced an inferior system of education for black people, which eventually led to the Soweto uprising of 1976, there were some things that they said you should not be taught, we black people. We were not allowed to be taught anything about the American War of Independence, because they said, why want to introduce subversive thoughts into the minds of our black people? The minister responsible for us said famously, why do you want to teach black people mathematics. What are they going to do with mathematics? Let them learn enough English and Afrikaans, which is the other official language, to be able to understand instructions given by their white employers. So our children, we were meant to be consigned to perpetual serfdom. And what happened in this country was always a source of inspiration. When I was 8 years or so of age, I picked up a tattered copy of Ebony magazine, and it was talking about Brooklyn Dodgers and Jackie Robinson breaking into Major League Baseball. I didn't know baseball from ping pong. But that didn't matter. It just was that I grew inches to know that someone who looked like me could overcome such great obstacles. Then I remember in the one cinema in one town serving black people from all along Johannesburg, what is called the Reef. The film that we saw was Stormy Weather. I don't know whether it was a good film or not. I don't care. Because for us to go to a movie and see black people like us acting, I fell head over heels in love with Lena Horne. And for a long time in our township, you saw guys talked out as if they were Cap Galloway and Fats Waller and all of those people. It was an incredible thing for us. So you see some of us who looked to this land incredible admiration, and your civil rights movement inspired us no end. We also had a dream. We also sang in our struggle, we shall overcome. Things that were inspiring us at a time when we were being roughed up. And so it was a kind of disillusionment, a pain that to know that the land that we aspired after what was happening here, that this land had this huge blot on it that you believed. I'm using this in a generic sense, okay? I don't mean you. You are on the right side. that you believed in the death penalty. And then you've heard all of the wonderful things that the Texas Coalition have been trying to say. The fact that Tom didn't say, that there clearly was a miscarriage of justice in the case of Dominic, because one of the guys who was with them, white, did not appear in court. And Tom has told you what happened to Dominic, how he was an incredible young man for trying to protect his younger siblings from his mother's quite callous attacks. the burning or holding of his hands over the flame and shoving her cigarette ends into his palms. Why do you do this when you are such lovely people? Why? If you wanted to apply for membership of the European Union, the United States would not qualify because the European Union demands that its members abolish capital punishment. Why do you continue when you have been given incontrovertible evidence that huge mistakes are made, that so frequently innocent people are convicted, often because they have such inadequate legal defense? In one instance where the judge rebuked a lawyer who was representing a black guy on capital charges because he was asleep during the proceedings. And you know, there is a university, I don't know which, you have so many, whose law school has this incredible project. They have helped to prove innocent I don't know how many people, where especially in rape cases, where they've been able to prove conclusively through DNA that this could not be the culprit. Why do you continue? Because this is a mistake you won't be able to correct. I mean, once you have executed a person, you have executed them. Tough luck, tough luck. We made a mistake, man. You can't get him back. Why? Why? Why when you're such an incredible country? I mean, look at what you've done. In November the 4th, look at what you did. Hey? Why do you do this? For most of us who are Christians, we have a different injunction. Do you know what it is doing to you? It is brutalizing. You might say, no, it doesn't really affect me. But it is brutalizing you. So that what happened in Alabama? 16 people. This country where you have the right to carry a gun. Last night I was speaking in Chicago, invited by the Chicago Bar Association, because how many kids have been killed? Huh? What are you doing to yourself? What are you doing to yourselves, you wonderful, generous people? What are you doing to yourselves? You're brutalizing yourselves. You're cautioning yourselves. Please, please, you are such a fantastic bunch of human beings. You really are, actually. You are some of the most... No, I am not looking for anything from you just now. You are some of the most generous people in the world. What are you doing to yourselves? Because you know, whether you like it or not, you are part of the system. And it's turning you into violent people. It's turning you into violent people. Please, please,
for your own sake, but really for the sake of the world, are now that better side of you, your generosity, your compassion, to the things that please, 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 you would not be so quick to fall on the basis of a lie. You destroy Iraq on the basis of a lie. Because you have come to begin to believe that force, that violence would be the answers. No. Gentleness, compassion, love are what are going to make our world a better place. I can just see Dominic, I was sitting across from him. He is the most eloquent reason for the abolition of the death penalty. He was sitting over there, and I really was awed by him. He had a gentle smile. I sat there. No. How could we kill this guy? And you say it is because you want to show your reverence for life by taking a life. We don't do that. It's one of the greatest obscenities. Please know that they are making you an obscene nation. If someone rapes, do you, in order to show how opposed you are to rape him in return? Why do you do it? With killing. Is it because you have killed? And don't think, that those who say abolish the death penalty mean that you've got to be lenient. No. 30 years life imprisonment is rough. But at least you still give the person the chance to be rehabilitated. You don't give up on anyone. Please.
Abolish the death penalty. Dominic Green executed on Texas death row.
The story of Dominic Green with Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Organics to You, locally owned and operated, and delivering local, organic, farm-direct produce to your door 52 weeks a year. To design your personal delivery schedule, the number is 503-236-6496 or organicstoyou.org.
Happy Monday. This is your community calendar for the 30th of March, 2009. The Portland Restaurant Workers Association is a community group made up of workers committed to promoting solidarity, support, and education among food service workers in our city. This evening at 7, the association will host a forum on the top 5 wage and hour violations in restaurants and how to protect your rights on the job. All are welcome to attend. Also this evening at 7, you are invited to a screening of the documentary Arid Lands. This internationally acclaimed film is about the land and people of the Columbia River Basin and the aftermath of environmental contamination and cleanup at the Hanford nuclear site. The screening will take place at First Unitarian Church at Southwest 12th and Main in downtown Portland. Tomorrow afternoon, Tuesday, March 31st, the Portland State University chapters of Mecha and Las Mujeres invite you to join a demonstration and march honoring the legacy of Cesar Chavez, legendary workers' rights champion and co-founder of the United Farm Workers. The demonstration will address ongoing campaigns for comprehensive immigration reform and workers' rights in the state of Oregon and nationwide. The group will gather up at noon at Portland State University's park blocks on the corner of Park Avenue and Harrison Street, and the march will commence soon after. Portland Hearing Voices is a new community learning partnership dedicated to education around hearing voices, unusual sensory experiences, and mental diversity. Tomorrow evening, Tuesday the 31st, Hearing Voices invites you to a documentary film screening and discussion presenting different points of view on these little understood phenomena. This event is wheelchair accessible and open to the public, and it will take place at 6 p.m. in the meeting room of the Multnomah County Public Library's downtown branch, located at 801 Southwest 10th Avenue at Yamhill. For more information about any of the events mentioned on the calendar, call the KBOO front desk at 503-231-8032 or check out the listings at kboo.fm/community calendar. And you have just heard the KBOO Community Calendar on 90.7 FM Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis, and 91.9 FM Columbia Gorge.
Howdy, everybody. I'm Rose Maddox, and I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, the station that I listen to when I'm in the area.